Good morning.
I see everybody left everything, you know, the real information from Cattle Facts. He delivers, you know, the stuff. I deliver the fluff, right? I'm the communications guy. What I want to do this morning is talk to you a little bit about how to talk about what it is that we do in the beef industry. How it is that we raise beef from pasture to plate today and the importance of getting out and telling that story to consumers. That's my job at the National Cattlemen's Beef Association on your behalf, is to work with the media, to work with social media tools and help get your story told to consumers and get you out in front of consumers so that you can answer their questions. You know, consumers have a lot of questions about the way their food is raised today, and you know, we can kind of hide behind the barn doors and do our thing on our farms and ranches, or we can get out and try to engage those consumers. And I think more and more it's important for us to get out and be the ones to answer their questions, because otherwise they're going to get misinformation from other sources. It's really easy to go on the internet and Google your questions and get a lot of a variety of different opinions and viewpoints about how food is produced today. There are a lot of different opinions about how food should be produced today, and that's okay. It's okay to have different opinions, but our opinions need to be heard. The people who are actually out there working the land every day, the ones who are actually out there taking care of cattle and raising these animals to produce safe, wholesome, nutritious beef, are the ones. Your voices are important, and your voices need to be heard. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about our Masters of Beef Advocacy program and the importance of engaging in that effort as well. So a little bit about my background, what brings me to you today. I'm a native Kansan.
Oh. Not a KU.
I'm not a Kansas University graduate. I do have a daughter who's a junior at Kansas University, though, so I do send a lot of money to Lawrence these days. But I'm also not a graduate of Kansas State University. I went to a small little school called Ottawa University, right down along I-35 in Ottawa, Kansas. And that's part of my family tradition. My mom and dad met there. I met my wife there. My brother met his wife there. And I have umpteen cousins and uncles and others who went to Ottawa University. Part of our family heritage, we're Southwestern Kansas Baptists. They came from North Carolina in the 1800s, the 1880s to be specific. My great-great-grandfather came through this area and pushed on through into Kansas City and settled down there for about 18 months and stocked up, and then headed west down the Santa Fe Trail to the first available land he could find. I've always told people I didn't come from a cattle background or a livestock background, because my family are Western Kansas wheat farmers. But I recently read an article in the Standard History of Kansas, 1916, about my great-great-grandfather, Americus Vespucius Angel, who settled in that area. And it turns out he did have cattle in those early days. The family story I've heard is actually he was hoping to settle somewhere in the Flint Hills and graze those cattle out on that nice green pasture, or that native tall grass prairie in the Flint Hills of Kansas. But that land was already all taken up, and so he ended up out in southwestern Kansas and became a wheat farmer. Actually, I think it was my great-grandfather who really settled in on wheat as their principal crop, because this story said he rebelled against picking up chips. You know, my family was one, that Angel family was one of seven families that settled in western Kansas in a little town called Plains in 1886. Seven families that built sod houses out there to begin the process of turning that area into the breadbasket of the world. And, you know, a lot has changed since that time. A lot has changed in the way that we raise food and the efficiencies and the productivity of American agriculture. But one thing that has stayed the same is that American agriculture has always been focused on finding ways to do things better, year after year, generation after generation, of better ways to raise food, more food with fewer resources, more food on less land. You heard Kevin talk about the fact that we're losing, you know, four million acres of land, you know, every year to urban encroachment. I mean, we're in a situation now where we're on sort of two trains on the same track racing towards each other, with the world population growing, according to the United Nations, going to double by the year 2050. And the amount of land available to produce food shrinking as that population grows and takes over that land. Within our lifetimes, I'm convinced that we're going to face that train wreck coming down, you know, that other train coming down the tracks. We're going to have to find ways, continue to find ways to produce more food with fewer resources if we're going to feed this growing world population. But I'm convinced that we're going to do it, and the American farmers are going to lead the way, because that's what American agriculture has always been about. And we just need to do a better job of getting out and telling that story. So I'm a native Kansan. I went out to Washington, D.C. My first job was on Bob Dole's 1988 presidential campaign. How many of you are even old enough in here to remember who Bob Dole is? Okay, good, Jamie. Glad to know that. Senator Dole is still alive, celebrated his 89th birthday this year. He's had some health problems recently, but you know, things were a lot different back in the 80s when I was working in Washington, D.C. People like Bob Dole actually worked together with people on the other side of the aisle, people like Ted Kennedy, who, you know, they couldn't have been more diametrically opposed in terms of ideology, but they got together and they worked on programs like food stamps and Women, Infants, and Children, and the American with Disabilities Act. And people like Senator George Mitchell and Senator Bob Dole worked together to get things done for America, and we don't see much of that happening in Washington, D.C. anymore these days, and I think that's a shame. Senator Dole wheeled in a wheelchair at the Senate floor last week to implore the senators, particularly Republicans, to vote for a piece of disabilities legislation, and they voted it down. And I think that tells you a lot about the state of where we are in Washington, D.C. And Kevin made one political statement. That'll be my last political statement. We've got to get together. We've got to insist that the people we send to Washington get together and start focusing on making positive decisions to move this country forward, and a lot of those involve agriculture and getting a farm bill passed and getting things like that done. But you know, I'm really here to talk about what we can do to reach out to consumers and tell our story so that we get the support that we need from the people who eat to do the job that we need to do to feed the world. Defending American, you know, animal agriculture was the title of my presentation, and you know, it seems like we are in a defensive mode a lot. And we tried real hard to get out of that, and through programs like the Masters of Beef Advocacy, to get out there proactively and share our story, the positive story of the work that we do, and yet we still face attacks from a lot of different sources. How many of you have seen this, have been following this series in the Kansas City Star? So Mike McGraw, who's a reporter at the Kansas City Star, a very good reporter. He's a University of Missouri School of Journalism graduate from right here in Columbia. An old school reporter who I have a lot of respect for, who won a Pulitzer Prize in the early 1990s, early in his career, he worked at the Des Moines Register with a team of reporters there that are some of the best that I've known in the business, like George Anthon. And you know, so he's a very good, solid reporter, and he came to us about a year ago and said he wanted to come to our convention in Nashville to learn about the beef industry. So I said, well, tell me, what is it that you want to know about the beef industry? What prompted you to do this story? He said, well, our editors at the Kansas City Star woke up that one day and realized we haven't done a very good job of covering agriculture. And they also realized that the beef industry is very important to Kansas City. And I said, Mike, I have to agree with you on both of those points. The beef industry is very important to Kansas City, and the Kansas City Star has not done a good job reporting on agriculture. And after reading this series, I would stand here today and tell you, I still don't think the Kansas City Star are doing a very good job reporting on agriculture. And they missed the story about the importance of the beef industry to Kansas City. And that's unfortunate. I'm not angry about the series, I'm disappointed. I'm disappointed that the opportunity that they missed. The story we tried to tell the Kansas City Star is that Kansas City is not the cow town that it once was, when the West Bottoms were full of cattle in the stockyards getting ready to be shipped out on rail to Chicago, to the slaughterhouses in Chicago. What Kansas City is today is a modern beef town. It's a town that is focused to be on the leading edge of beef production, with the Casey Animal Health Corridor that stretches from here in Columbia to Manhattan, Kansas, with the new National Bio and Agri Defense Facility there in Manhattan, the tremendous amount of research that's done at these two institutions, and the companies that are relocating and moving to Kansas City to be a part of that growing, profitable, sustainable beef industry. And Kansas City is going to be the hub of that. And that's good for every citizen of the state of Kansas and the state of Missouri and the residents of Kansas City and the readers of the Kansas City Star. That's an important story. It's unfortunate that story didn't make it into the Kansas City Star. But the Kansas City Star instead decided they wanted to tell a story about Big Beef in all caps. I guess as of this series running, Big Beef is now a proper noun to describe today's beef industry. So welcome to Big Beef. You're a part of it, according to the Kansas City Star. Now, is that a good thing or a bad thing? I don't know. I guess it's up to your interpretation. But when it comes to talking to the consumer about what it is that we do, it seems the consumer thinks that big is bad. That, you know, the consumer has concerns and questions about industrial agriculture and factory farming, the way that food is raised today. And that's okay. I understand consumers have questions. A lot of them fed by articles like this that raise questions about, serious questions about what it is that we do. You know, this article addresses serious issues, beef safety. The story on Sunday raised the issue of beef safety and mechanically tenderized steaks. That's a serious issue. You guys know that. You know that the safety of the product that we produce is the most important thing that we do, is produce safe beef. And you've invested millions of your own dollars through the Beef Checkoff in ensuring that beef is safe. And we've made tremendous progress against bacteria like E. coli in reducing E. coli illnesses. But rather than tell that story, they decided to focus on the negative and focus on some people who have gotten sick after eating mechanically tenderized steaks. Now, I want you to know that if anybody gets sick, and if you were living with a colostomy bag or you know, suffered through an E. coli illness, and it was you or somebody in your family, you would say, it doesn't matter how many people get sick. Doesn't matter if it's 100 people over the past 10 years. If it's you, if it's your family, that's a serious issue. I worked when I was at Fleischmann Hillard in Kansas City. I spent the first 10 years of my career in Washington, D.C., working with Bob Dole and then within agriculture trade associations in Washington. And then I came back home to Kansas and to Kansas City to work for Fleischmann Hillard Public Relations there in the mid-1990s, 1997. And E. coli in the beef industry was becoming we were realizing it's a very serious issue. People had gotten sick and young kids had died after eating at the Jack in the Box restaurants in 1993. And we had begun efforts at that point to start looking into E. coli and figuring out how to make beef safe from E. coli. And I worked on a recall in 2000 where a four-year-old girl died after eating beef. And my daughter was 4 years old at the time. I got to tell you, that really hit home. You know, thinking about my daughter and what it would be like to be that parent of that child who just ate a hamburger and got sick, developed hemolytic uremic syndrome from E. coli, and then, you know, kidney failure, and eventually died. I mean, that's a tragic story, and none of us wants that to happen ever to any consumer of our product, right? We understand that's a serious issue. But to focus that on that solely and not tell the positive story of the work that we've done and the positive story of the work that we will continue to do through the Beef Checkoff to make beef safer, I think was a missed opportunity. The Monday's story focused on the use of antibiotics. How many of you use antibiotics in here to treat sick cattle? And that's part of what we do, right? We have a responsibility to care for these animals. If they get sick, we have to work with the veterinarian and on a treatment for them, so they don't suffer and possibly die. I mean, that's what you do every day, is you care for animals. And we know that the issue of antibiotic resistance is a very, very serious issue. You know, if we lose these tools that we have to keep animals sick, or if we in some way compromise the medicines that we have to treat our own children, we understand that that's a very serious issue, and we don't want that to happen, right? So we use these products very judiciously. We use these products very responsibly, working with our veterinarians to make sure that we're being responsible stewards of those products and responsible stewards of those animals. And yet, rather than focus on that positive story and the contributions of things like the Beef Quality Assurance Program, funded in part through the Beef Checkoff to help farmers and ranchers all across the country understand the best ways to use those products responsibly, And to be good stewards of our animals, they decided to focus on the negatives and create the perception that we're creating some massive health concern out there with the use of antibiotics in livestock. And then yesterday, Was it just yesterday? Yeah, just yesterday. The third in the series, talking about Chekhov funding of nutrition research. So your Chekhov dollars, about 6 years ago, went into funding a research project at Pennsylvania State University. The point of that research project was to take one of the sort of age-old myths about beef, that beef is not heart healthy, that beef causes heart disease because beef includes saturated fat, and take that and look at it and say, you know, is there any truth to that, or is there any way that we can talk to consumers about including lean beef in a heart healthy diet, and what would be the outcome? So we took a diet called the DASH diet, the dietary approaches to stop hypertension. Now this is the diet, if any of you have ever gone to the doctor with high LDL cholesterol, signs of heart disease, maybe family history of heart disease, maybe overweight, and the doctor says, I'm concerned about you, I'm concerned about your heart health, I'm going to put you on the DASH diet. And the DASH diet would include a lot of fruits and vegetables, whole grains, and other products that are known to have good positive cholesterol lowering effects. It might be a little difficult for some of us to stick to that diet, was our premise. Because for people who love beef, and 94% of American consumers say they include beef in their diet, so a lot of people eat beef, and a lot of people say that they love beef, and they love the, you know, the taste of a steak and the sizzle of that steak on the grill and that hamburger of the 4th of July picnic, and they want to include beef in their diet. But they also want to eat healthier. So we said, well, let's look at that. So we took the DASH diet and said, if we incorporate lean beef into that diet, what would happen? Because the DASH diet includes very little protein. About 1 ounce of red meat per day is allowed in the DASH diet. Blue, I don't know when's the last time you had a 1 ounce steak, but
long.
You know, so what? And lo and behold, what happened was really interesting, in my opinion. What we found was that you can include lean beef, and when I talk about lean beef, I'm talking about some of the most popular cuts that are available today, like the top sirloin, tenderloin, a T-bone steak. Yeah, because you've got a tenderloin on one side and a strip loin on the other. A Kansas City strip, by the way. We don't call it a New York strip out here, right? You know the story of what happened there? Kansas City strip originally was a strip steak with the bone on it, and then New York chefs started taking it off the bone and calling it a New York strip. That's what it is. Technically, a Kansas City strip would be a bone-in strip, and I've actually seen both on the menu at a nice steakhouse in Chicago. You had a Kansas City strip and a New York strip. And that's the way they characterize it on their menu. But we need to win back the strip to Kansas City, right? We need to bring that bone back in there too, because that adds flavor and tenderness to that steak. But you know, these are some of America's most popular and most favorite steak cuts, lean cuts of beef. We can help consumers understand they can choose lean cuts. Just look for words like loin and round. You can choose lean ground beef. 93% lean or leaner ground beef meets the government definition of lean. And that's great news for people who love beef. But rather than tell that story, the Kansas City Star decided to tell a story of, you know, to imply that somehow funding research like that with your Chekhov dollars was nefarious, some nefarious plot to you know, push beef on Americans. It's just mind-boggling to me that we would conduct research that was of such high quality and such high standards that it gets published in the peer-reviewed American Journal of Clinical Nutrition this past January. This is one of the leading medical and health journals in this country. And if it's of high enough standard to make it into through the peer-reviewed process into that journal, that means it's good science. Just because you funded it with your Chekhov dollars, suddenly that makes it suspect to the Kansas City Star. I don't understand that. But that's the story they decided to tell about big beef. So I'll get off my soapbox. This is one of the reasons we created the Masters of Beef Advocacy Program. Because when we deal with mainstream media like the Kansas City Star, we don't always get our side of the story across. Now I'll tell you, Mike McGraw, I think, did made attempts to, he gave us opportunities, I'll say this, he gave us an opportunity to respond to all of the issues that he was raising. But I think just the use of the words big beef in all capital letters tells you where he was coming from and from the very beginning of the premise of his story. And he had that story written. And he left some holes to fill in some quotes from us. And that's balance in today's mainstream media. But that's the world we live with. Mainstream media is fighting for viability. Newspapers are going out of business. They're struggling to stay alive in a time when we can communicate to each other and get our news from Twitter and Facebook. And we don't have to get that daily newspaper to get our news anymore. So they're struggling to stay alive, so they write stories like this to try to sell newspapers. And I understand that. They're in business too. Kansas City Star is owned by a corporate media conglomerate called McClatchy Newspapers. So I guess they're big media. So we created the Masters of Beef Advocacy Program so that we could take our story directly to consumers, not through the filter of the media. Because when I started at NCBA back in 2006, there was this thing called Facebook that people were talking about that I wasn't sure what it was. I wasn't sure if it was just another kind of version of MySpace, something mostly maybe college students and others might be interested in. But I signed up for it back in 2006. And today, Facebook is one of the largest, you know, if you took just the members, just the people who are on Facebook, it'd be one of the largest countries in the world. It's a community of people worldwide that we can communicate to through our own social media networks, our own Facebook friends. And then Twitter came along. And I thought, oh gosh, here we go, another communications tool. Do I really have to learn a new communications tool? And I'm 48 years old. I've been in the communications business for 25 years. And I guess, you know, I was kind of facing that, like the first time my dad ever sat down at a computer to do an email, to having to learn a new communications tool. But then I learned what the difference is with Twitter is that we can communicate worldwide, globally, to, you know, 140 million people who are on Twitter and having conversations about things like where their food comes from. So we created the Masters of Beef Advocacy Program to equip you to get out and engage and tell your story. And the Wall Street Journal picked up on our program and called us up and said, hey, we want to do a story about this Masters of Beef Advocacy Program. A magazine called Mother Jones had written a story about the MBA program, and they called it Big Beef versus Michael Pollan. There we go again, Big Beef. Big Beef versus Michael Pollan. Turns out it wasn't actually the Kansas City Star that came up with that. And, you know, when we read this article, the whole premise of this article was that the MBA program was some sort of clandestine force to push big beef industrial agriculture on people. There we go again, this conspiracy theory. And that's not what it's about. The Masters of Beef Advocacy Program is about you, large and small ranchers, farmers and ranchers from all across the country. We've got people who raise their own beef and sell it at the farmers markets in Kansas City. From right here, you know, from Missouri farmers who are part of this program. And we've got large-scale feedlot operators who are part of this program. We represent the entire beef industry. We represent the entire beef community, the people who work together to raise today's beef, large and small. Producers of grass-finished beef, producers of grain-finished beef, producers of natural beef, producers of organic beef are all members of the Masters of Beef Advocacy Program. This program does not discriminate. It's a beef checkoff-funded program. Everybody who raises beef or is a part of what I call the beef community is eligible to participate in the MBA program. Today, after about 3.5 years, we have more than 3,600 graduates of this program nationwide in 48 states. I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. The Wall Street Journal said they wanted to do a story about the Masters of Beef Advocacy Program. So I said, that'd be great. I'd love to have you talk about this program because we got nothing to hide. But I will do this. I'll insist that you go through the program if you're going to write about it so you can really figure out what it's all about. So this reporter, Stephanie Simon from the Wall Street Journal, actually sat down, took the 6 online courses that are part of the MBA program, and came to an MBA commencement like the one that we're going to have tomorrow for graduates of this program. And she wrote a story about it, and I think she got the story right when she said that the course is really about training ranchers, feedlot operators, butchers, chefs, anyone really who loves a good, thick ribeye, anybody in this room? good thick ribeye lovers, in the fine art of promoting and defending red meat. That our goal is to convince consumers that our shrimp wraps, sirloin tips in the supermarket aren't ottery clogging commodities mass-produced on factory farms, but wholesome meals turned out with great care by hardworking families. How many of you consider yourselves family farmers? How many of you consider yourselves factory farmers? We might not use that term to describe ourselves, but if that term means that we do a very efficient job of raising more food with fewer resources, and then yeah, that's what we do. Kevin Good sat here and told you we raise 20% of the world's beef. He said with 10% of the world's cattle. Actually, the most recent numbers I've seen said 7% of the world's cattle. 20% of the world's beef with 7% of the world's cattle. So we're very efficient at what we do, better than any other country in the world. But that word efficiency doesn't always resonate with consumers. They might interpret that to mean that we cut corners to save costs. Are we trying to save costs? Well, of course. Any good businessman is going to try to lower their input costs, right, of the product that they produce. And we are business people. You know, my great-great-grandfather was a business person and living in Western Kansas. Now, you know, that family farm today is a corporation, Angel Brothers Incorporated. Because when my grandfather died and turned it over to his three sons and my mom, they incorporated it for tax purposes. But that doesn't make it a bad thing. It's still my cousin Roger who farms the family land out there. It's still a family farm. Very much so. But you know, consumers get confused when they hear words like efficiency. They might think that means that, you know, we're just all about cutting corners and saving costs. But that's not what we mean. What we're talking about when we say efficiency is using fewer resources to produce food, less land, less water, less feed, less fuel to produce beef. And that's important stuff. We just got to make sure that we're defining what we mean by those terms. So there's what we do. We turn out food with great care for family farmers and ranchers. And our whole goal with this program is to convince you that you need to get out and share your story, the story of what you do every day. The most powerful communications tool we have today with consumers is your story. You know, the MBA program is there to teach you all the facts and figures and things some of the things I'm rattling off the top of my head here, and you might say, well, I don't know. You know, how many of you in here can name the 10 essential nutrients and vitamins found in beef? All 10. Katie says she's got it. Anybody else? Sally? You know, Sally's an MBA graduate. I bet Sally can get at least three of them, right, Sally? What would those be? Zinc, iron, and protein. If you can remember ZIP, right? Yep. Zinc, iron, and protein. You've got three of the 10. Iron, protein. What else? What other essential nutrients and vitamins does beef provide? Any others?
Riboflavin.
That's one of the very obscure ones, John. I guess the executive director for the Missouri Beef Industry Council should know that. What does riboflavin do for your body, by the way? You know, when I talk to farmers and ranchers about talking about zinc and iron and protein and B vitamins, if you can remember ZIP plus B, B6 and B12, you've got five of the 10 right there. Zinc, iron, protein, B6 and B12. But when we talk to consumers, they say, so what? So what, zinc? Why do I care about the zinc? What does zinc do for you? Anybody? Helps build your immune system. Is that important?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's important if you don't want to be sick with cold all the time. We're you know, cold and flu season here. I haven't gone and gotten my flu shot. Anybody here gone and gotten their flu shot? I haven't gotten a flu shot, but I haven't had the flu in years, and I eat a lot of beef. Now, is it because of the zinc and found in beef? Well, I know that zinc boosts my immune system, so yeah, it has an impact on that. And I fly on airplanes all the time, by the way, with
really?
Flu germs circulating through that closed air system. So if anybody's going to get sick, it'd be me. Iron. What's iron do for your body? Strong bones.
It really allows you to breathe.
It allows you to breathe. How so? Explain to us.
Well, iron is a part of the red hemoglobin.
Right.
And if you don't have iron, the oxygen molecule is not attached to it.
That's exactly right. So what? Tell me your name.
Jim Laker.
what Jim's telling us here is that iron helps build healthy red blood cells, and red blood cells are the things that in your body that carry oxygen from your lungs to your vital organs and muscles. Is that important?
Well, sure.
Only if you want to live. That's what we call them, essential nutrients and vitamins, because they are essential to life. And iron deficiency, one of the major health issues, health concerns we have in this country, not just the world. A lot of people are iron deficient because we're not getting enough iron through our diet, because we're not eating enough beef, believe it or not. And, you know, so when we talk, it's important to know those things. I got off on a tangent again. I have a tendency to do that sometimes. But it's important to know those things about the product that you produce. That's what the Masters of Beef Advocacy program is there for. So you can talk about the 10 essential nutrients and vitamins that are available in the beef that you produce. Because if you're talking to a mom in Kansas City of school-age kids about something like Meatless Mondays, you've heard about Meatless Mondays, right?
Yes.
Premise of Meatless Mondays is that we should reduce meat consumption or not eat meat one day a week, because it would be better for our health and better for the environment. Better for our health. So we're going to take meat away from kids one day a week, and that's what's happening in some school districts. They're saying we're not going to serve meat that one day a week. When beef is helping build their healthy red blood cells, so that oxygen can get from their vital organs, from their lungs to their vital organs and muscles, which is important for physical activity. The First Lady wants us to, the Let's Move program is encouraging kids to get 60 minutes of physical activity a day. If you're going to get 60 minutes of physical activity a day, you need to fuel your body. And beef provides great fuel for those kids' bodies. We just need to be able to talk about that so that mom understands why beef is important in the school lunch program, because it helps build their immune systems by providing zinc. It helps build healthy, strong bones and muscles by providing, in 1 3-ounce serving, more than 50% of the protein we eat in a day for very few calories. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute if I don't run out of time, because I keep going off on tangents. I want to introduce you to a concept, maybe a little bit different way of thinking about or talking about what it is that we do, that we call the beef community. You know, when we describe what it is that we do or the industry that we're part of, we say we're a part of the beef industry, right? And then we turn around and say we don't want people to call us industrial agriculture or factory farmers, and yet we use those words, beef industry. So we were playing around with that one day, and I said, well, what about the beef community? Because really, we operate like a community. Just like back to Plains, Kansas, and those first 7 families that homesteaded out there in Plains, we depend on each other to survive in the U.S. beef community. How many of you raise beef by yourself all the way from calf to market weight, process it yourself at home, and then sell it directly to a consumer? Anybody? We've got a couple here, and that's great. If you can make that work, you found a way to make that business model work, I applaud that, and I say that's wonderful. That's great. That's a part of the beef community. How many of you are cow-calf folks who raise those calves and wean them at about 7 or 8 months of age and send them on to somebody else, a stocker, backgrounder, or perhaps a feeder? So that's most of the people in this room. So you depend on somebody else to take that calf that you raise up to the next level and eventually on down the line to become beef for the consumer, right? We depend on each other. We're a community. That's what a community is. It's a group of people with a common purpose that depend upon each other to get the job done. So I think we operate as a beef community in the United States. And if people like, that's Debbie Lyon's wife down there on the lower left and her family from White City, Kansas, out in those Flint Hills that I was talking about earlier. And they've got a really precious resource there in that natural tall grass prairie in the Flint Hills. And it's really good for grazing calves. It's not so good for growing crops. Because there's this thin layer of soil that sits on top of this thick layer of limestone. Or chalk rock, perhaps. No, nobody's going to follow me on that.
I know where you're going. I know where you're going. KU.
But it's not very good for growing crops out there. If we try to turn the Flint Hills of Kansas into an area to produce crops to feed the people, we create an environmental problem. And that's 85% of the land that where we graze cattle in the United States is not suitable for crop production. So when we hear people say things like, well, if we just weren't grazing all those cattle or growing all that corn to feed all those cattle, we could just grow crops to feed the world. Right? What plant products produce iron? What plant products produce iron?
Spinach.
We got one. Broccoli. Dark green leafy vegetables, kale, and things like that. Where do we grow those products? California? Arizona?
Mexico.
Mexico. Increasingly. A lot of our organic fruits and vegetables coming from Mexico. But we don't grow in the Flint Hills of Kansas, do we? We don't grow them in the Sand Hills of Nebraska. You don't grow a lot of that here in Missouri. How many of you would say you have land where you graze cattle that isn't really suitable for crop production?
Everybody.
Right? So what would happen if we tried to take those cattle off that land and start producing crops to replace the iron that we all need in our diets? We already have an iron deficiency problem in this country. Yes, you can get iron from plant-based fruits, from plant-based vegetables, plant-based crops, foods. But can we produce enough iron if we're not eating red meat? That's the question. We were contacted by ABC News recently, and they said, we want to do this new series called, we're doing this new series called What If? And our pilot episode is going to be, what if every American became a vegetarian? So we wanted to contact the National Cattlemen's Beef Association to see what your opinion on this would be. And I said, well, it's not my opinion, but I'm going to tell you, we'd have a major health problem in this country of iron deficiency. Because if we replace the iron that we get, beef is the most readily available source of iron in our diet. More people get the iron that they need every day from eating beef than any other food source. So let's just do the what if. Let's take beef away. Let's take red meat away. Pork, the other red meat, away. Right, and you know pork is a red meat, by the way, according to the USDA. The other white meat's an advertising slogan. It's because it's higher in hemoglobin, because it's higher in iron. It's got that iron that we need. So let's take that out of our diet and let's replace that with plant-based foods. So now we have to increase spinach production, kale production in this country exponentially. And where are we going to grow that? We already have huge issues, water availability in the Central Valley of California, where they grow a majority of those crops today. Where are we going to grow it? What would be the environmental impact? What would be the impact on our health? What we told the reporter from ABC News, and we haven't seen this story see the light of day yet, is that we not only would create massive environmental issues, but we'd create massive health problems for this country if every American became a vegetarian. Vegetarians should frankly be thanking us for eating beef, because they can then eat the spinach. Because if we weren't eating beef, we'd be eating all the spinach and there wouldn't be enough left for them, or the price of spinach would go through the roof, or we'd have to import a lot of spinach from other countries. I see the reporter over here is writing that down. I guess that was quotable. So the beef community includes people like Debbie Lyon's wife and her family, and that grass is really good in the Flint Hills of Kansas up until about 7 or 8 months of age, but then it really makes sense for them to maybe send those calves on to some wheat pasture out in western Kansas, maybe my cousin's land out there. We can graze those cattle out on that wheat pasture, that winter wheat over the winter time, and then maybe send them up to somebody like Ann Burkholder's feedlot up in Cozad, Nebraska. Who in this room knows who Ann is? Ann's a really fascinating woman. She's got a blog called The Feed Yard Foodie. Ann grew up in Palm Beach, Florida. She's a city girl. Had no experience in agriculture, didn't grow up on the farm. And she went to Dartmouth University, Ivy League school. She's very smart, very articulate woman. And while she was there, she married this guy from Nebraska. I know you're thinking, I just said she was very smart, and then I said she married a guy. She married this guy named Matt Burkholder, and after they got married and graduated from Dartmouth, they decided to move back to his family farm in Cozad. And they have a diversified operation there where they grow crops, they feed 3,000 head of cattle in a feed yard, they take the manure, they apply it back to the land, they grow crops to feed the cattle. that produce the manure that they spread back on the land. You get the picture. How many of you are involved in that kind of a diversified system? And Anne became fascinated with what it takes to raise these 3,000 animals on a daily basis, to care for 3,000 animals on a daily basis. She eventually, her husband Matt runs the crop side of their business, but her father-in-law ran the feedlot, and she eventually went to him and said, I want to take over the feedlot. I want to become the feedlot manager, and she did. And 3 years ago, she became our first, maybe 4 years ago now, she became our first national beef quality assurance award winner because of her tremendous dedication and commitment to following the principles of the beef quality assurance, the standards that were developed by the professionals, the veterinarians, the animal scientists, the people who really know how to best care for animals to not only to provide the best care for them, also to produce the highest quality beef. And she's our first National Beef Quality Assurance Award winner. She, on her blog, The Feed Yard Foodie, which was featured on Blog Her yesterday. Blog Her is this a page for female bloggers that it's kind of a conglomerate or a site that pulls all together these different blogs from women bloggers talking about antibiotic use and how she uses antibiotics to care for those animals responsibly, judiciously, to ensure that they're there for future generations, for our kids, but also for our animals, to keep them healthy. She's doing a great job reaching out and sharing her story and connecting with consumers on both coasts. But it's not just the East Coast and West Coast, by the way. It's right here in Kansas City and Columbia, Missouri. I guarantee you've got consumers here who question the use of antibiotics and how we use antibiotics and whether or not we're compromising the health of them and their families. We've got to get out and reach out to them and talk to them. One of the things I think is interesting about Anne is she has people who come to her blog and she say, where can I buy Burkholder beef? Where can I buy your beef at the grocery store, because I trust you and want to buy the beef that you raise. Now, she talks openly on her blog about using antibiotics and growth promotants and feeding corn to her cattle. She recently wrote a blog post called, the title of it was, It's Not About the Trailer. And on this blog post, she talks about the story of getting her first horse. When she moved to the farm, when she, a little girl, just like most little girls, she wanted a pony for her whole life. And when she moved back to the farm with her husband, Matt, she got her first horse. And she was always struggling to try to get that horse to load up on the trailer. The horse didn't want to get up on the trailer to go down to this one pasture she wanted to take it down to. But over time, working with that horse, getting to know that horse, building a trust relationship with that animal, she got to the point where all she has to do is point at the trailer and the horse gets on the trailer. The horse knows what she wants her to do and responds and trusts her that there's nothing nefarious going on there. The point of that blog post was that it's all about trust. And she says at the end, she says, I don't think it's about antibiotics. I don't think it's about hormones or corn feeding. I think it's about trust and whether consumers trust us to do the right thing. You know, of course, we know we do the right thing. I mean, we know that caring for the land is the right thing to do because we got to pass it on to the next generation. And we've been doing that for generations. We know that caring for those animals that we're raising to produce food is the right thing to do, is to provide great care for them, because every animal that we sacrifice for our own food deserves to have a good life. So we have to provide good care for that animal. We know that we're doing the right thing, but we've maybe lost that trust of the consumer because we've got this disconnect. So by reassuring them that we really are a community of people, and by the way, the consumer is a part of this community. The people who buy our beef and eat beef are part of this beef community that works together to provide beef for the world. 97% of cattle farms and ranches across this country are family-owned and operated. That's something I think the consumer has lost sight of when we talk about factory farms. They maybe don't believe it anymore. Don't believe that you really exist. One of the reasons it's important for you to get out there and share your story. Because consumers like farmers and ranchers. 75% of consumers say that farmers and ranchers, they have a favorable or highly favorable opinion of farmers and ranchers. Those are great numbers. If you're running for president, that's a good favorability rating right there. The problem is when we ask them about how they feel about the way that food is grown and raised, they say they're not so sure. Those favorability ratings dropped to 42%. Now we're talking about favorability ratings maybe for the presidential candidates we had in the last election. You know, so consumers have questions. Have questions about how their food is grown and raised. Are these legitimate questions? Blue says yes. Yes, Andy? Yeah, yes. I think that's one of the most important things we can do is we can acknowledge that these questions are legitimate questions, legitimate concerns. And are you concerned about the health of your family and the safety of the food that you eat? We're consumers too, right? Are you concerned about making sure that livestock are treated properly? You know, for that consumer who's seen that video on YouTube or, you know, of an animal being mistreated, to question whether or not animals are that are raised to produce food are treated properly, that's understandable. They see visual evidence that it sometimes isn't happening the way we'd like for it to. Just means we've got to work harder. We've got to work harder to make sure that every animal is treated properly. One of the things you can do to be a good advocate for the beef industry is if you've got a neighbor, or you've got somebody, you're aware of something that's going on that's not right, you've got to put a stop to it. You've got to call attention to it some way. Because any time we get one of these videos, gets posted up on YouTube, it destroys all of the good work that you've done. All the good work of the Beef Quality Assurance Program with one visual image. One person doing it wrong. So we've got to stop saying, there's bad apples in every industry. Because that makes it sound like we accept that, and we don't accept that. We can't accept bad apples in our industry. There's too much at stake here. We're producing food for our own families. We can't accept bad apples in our industry. If we've got bad apples in our industry, we need to get them out. Are cattle causing global warming? You know, when I joined NCBA in 2006, I had never heard this notion that cattle were causing global warming. I knew the beef industry had a lot of issues. I've worked on those issues, primarily in beef safety and things like mad cow disease. But I didn't know that cows were causing global warming. Where did that come from? It came from a 2006 study that the United Nations Food and Ag Organization put out called Livestock's Long Shadow. In that study, they said that 18% of our global greenhouse gases come from livestock production, all of livestock production globally. More than all of transportation combined, which they pegged at about 14%. Now here's the first thing I want you to know about that study. That comparison right there of livestock to transportation has since been rescinded by the lead author of that study, Dr. Pierre Gerber, who said, actually that wasn't a very fair comparison. And the reason he says that is because we pointed out to him through a research project funded by your checkoff dollars, that the life cycle analysis that they were using on livestock took everything into account that they could blame on livestock, including deforestation in the Amazon. If you were deforesting in the Amazon to make room to graze livestock, they said that's a greenhouse gas contributor that we're going to put the livestock. Now, for transportation, all they looked at was emissions from vehicles. They didn't look at greenhouse gases contributed through drilling for oil, refining oil into gasoline, running automobile plants, factories, smelting steel, harvesting rubber. I mean, they didn't look at any of that stuff. They just looked at emissions from vehicles. So they've since rescinded that statement. The other thing you need to know about that is what they were talking about is globally livestock production, greenhouse gas contributions. Deforestation in the Amazon was 6% of that 18%. So one-third, not 6% of the 18%, but 6%. So one-third of that 18% was deforestation in the Amazon. Are we deforesting in the United States? Do we have more or less forest land in the United States today than we had 100 years ago?
More.
We're not deforesting here. We're adding forest acreage. Adding forest acreage at the same time we're losing arable land acres to produce food. How are we doing that? We're producing a lot more beef on a lot less land. That's how we're doing it. We're producing a lot more corn on a lot less land, a lot more wheat on a lot less land, because we're improving productivity year after year, generation after generation. You know, wondering if red meat causes heart disease or cancer, that's a legitimate question. That's a legitimate concern. Both my grandfathers died of heart attacks when I was in my teens. They were in the, they're both in their 60s. And what I heard is because they ate too much red meat. You know, Grandpa, he loved his steaks. And he did. He overcooked them, but he loved them.
Oh, that's the problem.
And what he really loved was that fat around the outside of the steak.
Oh, man, that's
nasty. Because when you overcooked them, it got nice and black and crunchy. And how many of you like that? And, you know, so I grew up thinking that red meat caused my grandfather's heart attacks. I mean, that's a legitimate question. That's a legitimate concern. And yet I eat beef every day. Why would I do that? If I was concerned that I was going to cause cancer for myself and my family, I have 2 teenage daughters. By the way, I've always said if they ever wanted to rebel against Dad, the easiest thing for them to do would be come home, tell Dad that they become a vegetarian. Right? And yet, I went to my daughter's soccer banquet last year, and you know, everybody gets an award these days in sports programs, and so they were giving out the awards, and she took up soccer 2 years ago, and most of the other kids are well more advanced than she is. She's not the best player, but she gives it her all. And she got an award for the most improved player in her second year. When you start off with low expectations, it's easy to improve, right? And they announced her, and they called her up for her award. They called her Haley Beef Williams because she wears her I Heart Beef T-shirt to soccer practice all the time. And she's got friends that she talks about the importance of beef, zinc, iron, protein, B vitamins, and things that you get from beef, and the importance of providing fuel for your body for physical activity. I'm proud dad. So those are legitimate questions. And when you think about it this way, the way a farmer from Indiana captured it, said, you know, after a long day in the field, you come home, you check your Facebook page, you check Twitter, and you're seeing all this negative stuff, you pick up the Kansas City Star. It's easy to feel attacked. But really, all consumers want to know is more about their food, and that's fairly reasonable. And it's reasonable for the Kansas City Star to want to know more about the beef industry in Kansas City. I'm glad the Kansas City Star wants to know more about the beef industry in Kansas City. I just wish they'd chosen to highlight some of the positive things that are happening, because I see a lot of positive happening in this industry. I see a lot of positive happening in the beef community, the product that we produce. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip ahead a little bit here. And we talk about producing more, and when we talk about those positive things that are happening in this industry, this is what I'm talking about right here. According to this research conducted by Dr. Jude Capper when she was at Washington State University, we produce more beef with 33% less land. We produce the same amount of beef with 33% less land, 12% less water, 19% less feed, and 9% less fossil fuel energy than we did just 30-some years ago in 1977. Those are huge numbers. Huge numbers. When we think about feeding a global population high-quality protein that provides zinc and iron and B vitamins, things that we can't get from some plant-based foods, or that would be in short supply with plant-based foods if we didn't have beef, this is important stuff. And this was funded by your beef checkoff dollars. We do this research because we think these are important issues. We do this research not so I can stand up here and pat you guys on the back and say, hey, you're doing a great job. It's good enough. We can stop there. We do this research so we can understand where we stand today and what improvements we can make for the future. We've just launched a major sustainability initiative within the beef industry through your checkoff dollars that is going to look at, it's going to take this information as a starting point. This is not a perfect study. It's based on modeling, you know, and models. But we're going to go out and we're going to really say, where do we stand in terms of environmental impact today? Sustainability, not just environmental, but social and economic sustainability as a beef industry in the United States. And what can we do to improve? Most importantly, what can we continue to do to improve? Because we know that American farmers and ranchers are never happy sitting back and saying the way we do it today is fine. We don't need to get any better. We've reduced E. coli illnesses to less than one case per 100,000 people, but we're not going to stop there. That's not good enough if that's your child. We met the Healthy People 2010 goals set by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They said we want to reduce E. coli illnesses to less than one case per 100,000 people. We met that goal. Now they've changed that goal for the Healthy People 2020 goals to 0.6 E. coli illnesses per 100,000 people, so almost cutting that again in half, and we're going to meet that goal too. Because we're going to continue to invest your checkoff dollars in beef safety research to make sure that nobody gets sick and dies after eating a hamburger. Because it's that important, and we know that. We're going to continuously improve our environmental footprint. We're going to find ways to do this better. Because we have to, in order to feed a growing world population, we have to find ways to do it better. I'm going to come back to that bull study real quick. You know, it bothers me, frankly, that the Kansas City Star would call into question the integrity of the researchers that we work with through the beef checkoff. Because these are professionals. These are the best in their business. And for them to accept funding for your dollars to do this research, there's nothing, absolutely nothing untoward about that. It's absolutely appropriate, not only appropriate use of your checkoff dollars, but exactly what your checkoff dollars are there to do. If we don't do that kind of research to help Americans understand how beef can fit in a healthy diet, and then do the subsequent communications around that. And by the way, every communication we have put out about this study says that what this study says is that you can improve your heart health if you include lean cuts of beef, control saturated fat in your diet, eat proper portion sizes, and pair beef with other heart healthy foods. We've got to eat more fruits and vegetables. We know that. We need to eat more whole grains. We know that. We're not saying eat as much beef as you want and smother it in gravy and you'll be fine. By the way, we trim those steaks. We trim a lot of that fat off those steaks that my grandfather would have eaten. And whether or not that caused his heart attack, I don't know. But what I do know is that this study says we can enjoy beef every day as part of a heart-healthy diet if we do some other good things to make sure that diet is balanced. And by the way, get a little bit of exercise. Beef provides more than 10% of 10 essential nutrients and vitamins that our bodies need every day. They are essential nutrients and vitamins. Riboflavin, John. Somebody came up to me after one of these sessions. They said, well, you're always telling us, you know, we've got to make sure we talk about what these things do for you. So what does riboflavin do, smart guy? And I said, you know what? I have no idea. So I went and looked it up. Riboflavin helps your body digest protein. I wonder why you would find riboflavin in beef. Think maybe God intended it that way? That'd be my personal opinion. You gonna find riboflavin in protein waters? No. Protein bars? No. I call beef nature's protein bar. 50% of the protein you need every day. Look at that. Almost 50% of your protein you need every day in a 3-ounce steak. A 3-ounce steak. Now that's a government definition of the serving size of beef. It's 3 ounces. Or about the size of the palm of your hand. That's a serving size. And I know, Blue, you're looking at the palm of your hand and you're saying, well, I'm glad I got a big hands because I can eat a little bit more beef.
It's 100%.
But look at that. Less than 10% of your daily calories. More than 10% of 10 essential nutrients and vitamins for less than 10% of your daily calories. That's a big deal. That's why beef is considered a nutrient-rich food. If we're going to talk to Americans about improving their health through their diet, we've got to talk about eating more nutrient-rich foods. More foods that provide the nutrients we need without the calories we don't need. Speaking of calories and plant-based sources of protein, to get that same 25 grams of protein that you get from that 3-ounce steak for 154 calories, if you try to go to tofu or black beans or peanut butter, you're increasing your calories off the charts. That's one of the things the school lunch programs say. If we do meatless Mondays, we can't serve meat. We maybe serve black bean cakes. Well, look at the amount of calories we're going to add to those kids' diets if we do that. Is that responsible? All in the name of following some anti-meat campaign called Meatless Mondays. You know, they came up with that mantra, Meatless Monday is going to help you improve your health and improve the health of the environment by cutting out meat one day a week. I think the exact opposite is true. If we cut meat out of our diet, it's going to be detrimental to the environment, it's going to be detrimental to our health.
We need to get out and talk to consumers about these issues.
Let me just ask you two quick questions, and I'll wrap this up. Which one of these guys do you think looks healthier? You know what I love about this picture is this isn't to say that you can't have a vegan diet and that you can't be healthy on a vegan diet. Both of these guys just finished a 15K race. That's 9.3 miles. They're both healthy. The guy on the right is a friend of mine, Dane Rauschenberg. He's an extreme athlete. He ran this year 350 miles up the coast of Oregon from California to Washington State in 7 days, 50 miles a day. He ran back in 2006 a marathon a week for a year, 52 marathons in 1 year. I met him after a race in St. Louis called the Go St. Louis Half Marathon with Team Beef, with Missouri Team Beef. And he had the same bag of goodies. We were getting on the plane to fly back to Denver. He was flying back to his home in Portland. And I saw that he had the bag from the race, and I said, hey, how'd you do in the race? Did you have a good race? And he said, well, it was okay. A 3:10 marathon, 3 hours and 10 minutes. That's a really good time. And I said, oh, that's a great time. That would be my goal. If I ever ran a full marathon, would be under 4 hours. So that's a really good time. I ran my personal best that day, about an hour 50 half marathon, and I was happy with that. But I said, so tell me, I got a question for you, because whenever I have an opportunity to bring up beef in a conversation, I do. And I said, so tell me, as a runner, as an athlete, how do you feel about beef and beef's role in a healthy diet? He said, I got three words for you. I love beef. I eat a big steak the night before every race and the night after every race, because I know that beef provides things that my body needs. Now, he didn't really know like all about zinc and iron, protein, B12 and B6. He does now, because I've drilled it into him. He just knew that beef did something for him that helped him perform. It helped him recover to do that marathon week after week, race after race. And he said, so I said, so tell me, that three hours and 10 minutes, was that a good time for you? And he said, well, not a great time. He said, but this was a training run. Not a training run. Who does a marathon as a training run? He said, yeah, I'm getting ready to run this 202-mile relay from Gettysburg, Pennsylvania to Washington, D.C. I said, oh, a relay race, that's where you get a team and a bunch of people and everybody does a leg and then you do another leg and you keep running. We had the Montana Running Ranchers ran the Hood to Coast 197-mile relay race for the past couple of years. So everybody takes a turn. I said, so how many people on your team? He said, one. I'm doing it solo. That May, he ran from Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, 202 miles to Washington, D.C. in 50 hours and 16 minutes. So it's called an extreme athlete. And he eats beef every day. So let me ask you another question. Which one of these guys looks healthier to you? The guy on the left, not Santa Claus, not the guy with the beard? That's me. That's me at age 30, living in Washington, D.C., not getting any exercise. In my 20s, I gained about 7 pounds per year. I was in high school. I was growing up in Topeka, and then in high school, I was the kid they called string bean, bean pole, all those things. About 6'4", 175 pounds. And then college, I started gaining some weight. I graduated college at about 200 pounds, and then all of a sudden, at age 30, here I am at 270 pounds. Out of shape, overweight. I go to the doctor. The doctor says, you got high LDL cholesterol. Your triglycerides are out of whack. You're showing early signs of type 2 diabetes. And you have a family history of heart disease. What are you doing? What are you doing to yourself? He said, if you don't change something now, if you continue on this path for another 10 years, you'll be some 340 pounds by the time you hit 40. And if you hit 40. If you make it that far. My second daughter had just been born, and I said, I better do something. Now, you may think I'm going to stand up here today and tell you that the big change I made in my life is I started eating more beef, and that's not what I'm here to tell you. I already ate a lot of beef. What I'm here to tell you is the big change I made in my life is I started exercising again. I went out and bought a bike and started riding my bike. Now I will say that the more I rode that bike, the first time I rode 10 miles, 20 miles, I remember the first time I rode 20 miles, I thought, wow, That was a long bike ride, 20 miles. How many of you in here would think that's a long bike ride? 6 years ago, right before leaving Kansas City, I rode from Kansas City to St. Louis in 4 days, 100 miles a day. Rode through little towns like Bunston, Missouri, and just all across the back roads across the southern part of Missouri. Kansas City to Sedalia, Sedalia to Jeff City, Jeff City to Warrenton, and then Warrenton over to across the ferry across the Mississippi River to Alton, Illinois, down the Great River Road to Illinois, and end up at the Arch in 4 days, 100 miles a day average. And I eat beef every day. Every day, because I know that beef provides the fuel that my body needs to do that kind of physical activity. On the right there, that's June 11th of last year, June 11th of 2011, when I had just finished the Boise Half Ironman Triathlon. What that means, that's a 1.2-mile swim in 50-degree water, followed by a 56-mile bike ride, just a little ride in the park, and then a 13.1-mile run with 50 other Team Beef athletes. People who are out there every day demonstrating that beef is an important part of a healthy diet. Beef is an important part of a healthy lifestyle. That's the story. That's the story I wish the Kansas City Star had told. The story of how beef can fit in a heart healthy diet, and how we're working to get out there and share our story and let people know that they can include beef in their diet, as long as they make other responsible dietary decisions and get some exercise. So here's my challenge to you today. Share your story. Find a way to share your story with the consumer today, tomorrow, every day of your life. Find a way to share your story with somebody in your neighborhood, in your close circle of friends, on your Facebook page, through Twitter, through your blog. Lou, do you have a blog? But you know people, and you can share your story with everybody you know, because your personal story is the most powerful communications tool you have. Be the face of the beef community, like Brenda, Sierra, Angel there on the right, and the Team Beef folks out there demonstrating, you know, the importance of beef in a healthy diet. Ronnie, right?
Jimmy.
On the right, Jimmy Long. Is Jimmy in there? All Masters of Beef Advocacy graduates. So how do you sign up for the MBA program? Go to www.beef.org/MBA and join this nationwide network of grassroots advocates for the beef industry who are getting out there every day sharing their story. We've got 3,600 people nationwide out there every day sharing their story with their friends and family and through social media tools. And they're making a difference. We are making a difference. Debbie Lyons Blythe from White City, Kansas is going to be on Anderson Live tomorrow. Do you know what Anderson Live is? Anderson Cooper's new 1 hour long daytime show. They were taking questions from viewers about food. They said, hey, we want to hear what your questions are about food. This is a program through the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance. One of the questions that they got was about organic. A 24-year-old woman from New York City said, I'm struggling to afford to buy food. I live in the city. I don't have, I'm early in my career. Don't make a lot of money. Do I need to pay extra for organic food? And so they matched her up. They flew her out to White City, Kansas, and took her to Debbie's farm, and they talked about the use of antibiotics and the use of hormones and what that means in beef cattle production. And just simply explain, this is what the differences are. Now, if you feel more comfortable buying organic and paying more for it, then that's okay. But you can also feel comfortable about buying the beef that Debbie raises at her farm, and she uses antibiotics and they use growth promotants, because we use those responsibly in a way that doesn't adversely impact the quality of that beef. And it's less expensive. And you can feel comfortable about buying that product too. It's all about choices for the consumer. And so then she's going to go back to Anderson's live TV show and talk to Anderson Cooper about what she learned on her visit to the farm. This is the kind of work that your beef checkout dollars are doing to engage consumers in conversations about beef and need to be a part of it. We need your help. We need your help, so sign up for the MBA program. I know it's almost lunchtime and I'm out of time, so I'm going to turn it back over. And I appreciate your attention.